Now it's time for part two of our pay disparity item. We started last week by interviewing Deborah Hargreaves of the High Pay Centre in London, talking about the difference, the gap, between the highest paid in the UK and the average paid. New Zealand's turn this week, and we're speaking with Paul Barber. He's a policy advisor with the New Zealand Council of Christian Services based in Wellington. Paul has been doing research, basically going over other people's work on pay disparity in New Zealand to get a picture of what it's like here. Of course, we all know in New Zealand we are living and working in what's termed a low-wage economy. I spoke with Paul on the telephone, and my first question was to ask what research he's been doing into pay disparity.
Now, we look at the issue that there's high inequality in New Zealand, and if you look at the fact that disposable incomes for the whole bottom half of New Zealand have fallen since 2009, there's an issue about, if one group's incomes are falling, what's happening to the other incomes? And at the same time, you're seeing top incomes not falling, and in some cases rising quite steeply.
So, Paul, are you saying that pay disparity started to emerge in New Zealand as recently as 2009?
If you look over the past 2 to 3 decades, we've seen low and middle incomes either stagnant or barely rising at the same time as top incomes have more than doubled. And one aspect of those top incomes have been the rises in executive CEO level salaries, as well as obviously rises from other sources such as income from wealth.
What in your view then is the underlying cause of pay disparity in New Zealand? Could it be something as simple as that an employer, for example, may award their staff a 3% pay rise, so those earning more will get a bigger pay rise, and the gap starts to emerge in that way?
Well, I think there's probably been a number of things going on. Firstly, it's been unlikely that that the 3% that's been paid to workers has been the 3% that's been paid to senior executives. It looks more like they've had 10, 20% increases, doubling packages in some cases. If you look at information from Strategic Pay, the SEO average pay doubled between the late 90s and the late 2000s. At the same time, whereas average wages totally only rose by 50%, and those averages, of course, dragged up as well by those high salaries. So
right.
When you talk about an average, you've got to realise that most people in New Zealand are earning below the average. So I think there are other dynamics going on, and one of the issues for everyone looking at this is trying to understand how executive pay is calculated and developed. And it seems to be an area that there's it feels at times like a parallel universe is operating, where there's a self-reinforcing logic where boards and are advised by pay consultants about what the market is, and everybody wants to pay above the average, of course, and that ends up ratcheting up pay, and as boards also test their own remuneration from similar information, they tend to vote themselves those similar increases as well. So you've seen both board directors' fees increasing pretty much to match what they're paying the executives. So the people making decisions about each other's pay are rewarding each other. And I think that seems to be a dynamic that's quite clear in what work's been done. A second issue, of course, is that New Zealand is a part of the world economy, and it's a worldwide trend, the rise in high pay. However, there are places where that's been less marked, and it would be wonderful to see more work done to explore what has worked in those countries to perhaps show some restraint in this area. Because it seems from the evidence that we've looked at that if you are able to restrain the gap between the highest and the lowest pay within an organisation, it's good for that organisation as well. It's obviously for the organisation itself, as well as obviously for those working in it.
I wonder how much does New Zealand's remote location play in ramping up salaries? For example, are Kiwi firms overreaching to pay excessive salaries to attract high flyers to what is a country in a remote location?
It's incredible. What I do find is incredibly interesting when the researchers do look at the so-called international market for top executives. The research suggests that this international market isn't as international as one might think. Many corporations recruit their CEOs from their own people internally, and that is promoting their own executives to these roles.
Right.
And that the international market doesn't generally seem to mean people moving countries. If you look at the Fortune 500 companies' work that's been done with them, you don't actually get as much mobility of executives around the world as we're led to believe. It's a tiny, tiny fraction, about, I think, 0.5% or something like that.
Mm.
And so I don't know, in New Zealand, I don't know that anyone's actually done the work to tell us how many New Zealand companies really are recruiting from overseas, or whether we are similarly looking at overseas packages, but in actual fact appointing New Zealanders and just paying them more. So, I mean, that's a... And you have to look at organisations that are prepared to promote people internally. There's also a tendency that those that do promote internally actually don't pay as much. So, I mean, there are those dynamics happening in the market, which there's not a lot of information about to actually test these theories. It's quite a bit of talk, quite a bit of opinion, and it would be wonderful to see more work done on that.
From what you've read, Paul, how big is the disparity between the highest paid and the lowest paid in New Zealand?
The disparities, again, depends how you measure it. We've did a couple of week comparisons between, for instance, annual salaries, politicians, senior government officials, private sector CEOs, state-owned corporation CEOs, and things. I've looked at some of the comparisons that have been published. I'd have to say it's not our work. We've looked at others' work, and you could, for instance, head of Mighty River Power. Was a semi-state-owned corporation these days, earns about $1.5 million a year. That's a ratio to the minimum wage of 53-1. If you look at the Air New Zealand CEO, however, also a very successful company, earns $625,000 a year, and 22 times the minimum wage. The head of Treasury earns about the same as the Air New Zealand CEO, $600,000, 21 times the minimum wage. In fact, the head of Treasury earns a lot more than the Prime Minister, who earns $428,000 a year, which is 15 times the minimum wage. If you look at a teacher earns 1.6 times the minimum wage, and a parliament cleaner is on the minimum wage. And if you're on an unemployment benefit, you're really in trouble. You earn 0.4 of the minimum wage.
I must say, it always seems strange to me that the unemployment benefit is not closer to the minimum wage.
There was a decision in the early 90s to basically cut benefits significantly, and that's never been reversed, and that's been anchored into New Zealand in the last 25 years, essentially. So,
what are the real-world implications to families, then, and the New Zealand economy of the pay disparity? Two questions in one there. So let's start with your view of the impact on people who just don't earn enough to get by.
High pay sends a lot of messages, and I think the message that, for instance, if you look at the ANZ bank CEO who earns $4.1 million a year, that's 150 times the minimum wage, it sends a message to people that on those low salaries that they have no value, and that there are some people who are worth some extraordinary percentage of them whose hourly work is, for some reason, a couple of hundred times more valuable than your work. If you look at the reality of what happens in organisations, it's hard to justify that. so I think it sends a message that you don't matter. And people also feel that there's a lot of evidence to show and from research all around about the impact of disparities on people's self-worth, their motivations, their general mental well-being. And that's one of the challenges that New Zealand's facing, is that we have high rates of various forms of mental illness. And there's definitely strong evidence to show that they're connected with some of these gaps that are created. Similarly, the issue seems that it's not only the highest paid, obviously, in an organisation that skews the whole pay scales within those organisations. So you can be sure that having high executive pay structures literally sucks away resources that would otherwise be available to lift wages for the lower paid in an organisation. And then there's the third point, just about the whole motivation around pay. There's been a huge amount of evidence emerging that high pay doesn't even motivate people very well. That's giving somebody earning a lot more doesn't necessarily improve their performance. And when you look at the relationship between what executives are paid in organisations and how those organisations perform, there doesn't actually seem to be much relationship. For instance, you double their pay, it doesn't mean to say the company suddenly doubles its performance.
Mm.
So there's real question marks about the value to the company, as well as the ability that has for the company to actually look after all its workers. And the converse of that is, there's a lot of evidence to show that if you look after all your workers and ensure there is a gap isn't too strong, that builds that sense of cohesion, commitment, engagement of workers, because they begin to feel valued. And often organisations that have flatter pay structures are actually much more involve their employees much more in the processes and decision makings within the organisation. So they deliver those other values that motivate people. And related to that is that third aspect, when you look at the research has been done to examine what motivates CEOs, senior executives, I guess, most of them would not put their pay at the top. In fact, many of them, you could argue, would be doing their job if they were paid a fraction of what they earn, because their satisfaction they get from is having a leadership role, having power, having the ability to make something significant in their world of expertise or in the world generally.
I know that I read regular criticism, particularly in the business press, that our productivity is not as high as it could be. Does New Zealand's low-wage economy play any part in this?
There's kind of two sides to that. I think, firstly, if you look at New Zealand workers over the past 20, 30 years, we work a lot, we're among the longest working. You know, we work the most hours of many countries, equivalent developed countries that we're talking about. I think our average hourly hours per worker are way higher than similar countries like in Europe or the States the other OECD countries.
Right.
So we do work hard, but our productivity has risen. But workers are working harder and producing more per hour, but their pay has not gone up to match that. And there's a lot of argument about why that might have been. And I don't pretend to be an expert in all the details of how productivity is measured and calculated. A real thing has been that, despite productivity raises, this whole dynamic of returns being accumulating to capital, you might argue. That is, returns have gone to executives, shareholders, rather than to workers. But the other side of the argument is that it's the demotivating effect of poor wages, because it makes, not only is it not highly motivating that you don't have any prospect of lifting your wages if you work harder, but secondly, if there's 40% of families in poverty at the moment people working in their household. So a lot of people are struggling to get by even though they are in employment. Of course, if you're struggling to get by, there's all sorts of other pressures on you around health, ability to actually improve your education or that of your family, housing stresses and that adds. Mm. Those are the actual pressures of living in poverty, and added to that comes that whole idea of your status. And as I mentioned before, there's a lot of evidence that simply the big gaps between high and low incomes devalue people, and they add to that psychological pressure on top of those practical pressures of just trying to get by.
Looking at the wider economy in New Zealand, people on low wages may not be able to afford the products their company makes.
Well, that's a really practical point that's often made about pay. If you increase the pay, the incomes of people on low incomes, they spend it all again because they need to. They're already not getting by, and they'll be looking after themselves, their families better, and they'll be spending that money locally within New Zealand. They won't be going off. They won't be buying shares offshore or heading off on overseas trips. They'll be buying goods and services within New Zealand. So there's a real issue that if we're not lifting, that would be a real stimulus to New Zealand economy for the better if we were able to lift the low incomes. Would appear that it's actually perfectly doable, and that it really is a case of asking how we can do it and not if it's possible. I think that and one of the issues for New Zealand is we're a very wealthy country overall. It's just that we've become much worse in the last two, three decades in distributing the wealth that we have, the income that we have. Really.
Given the amount of research you've done into the subjects of pay disparity, what in your view can be done today to start to correct the pay disparity in New Zealand?
Companies can choose tomorrow to make changes. There's nothing to stop any company, any organisation making a decision that they're going to, for instance, introduce a ratio between the highest and the lowest paid. And that immediately creates a relationship, quite a specific relationship between those on the highest incomes and the lowest incomes in an organisation. It becomes in the interest of the CEO to raise the wages of the lowest in order to ensure that his or her own wages can go up. And the ratio is quite a fascinating tool that can be used as a voluntary thing by organisations. It can be used by those investing in organisations to say, look, you know, we're interested in investing in organisations that don't have an excessive gap between the highest and the lowest paid. Tell us what you do. And if institutional investors started asking questions like that of companies, you might see some pretty rapid changes, I would think. You could look at having such ratios as legislative, either as regulations or passing actual laws around them. Mm. And you could look within government-funded and government-owned organisations such as government departments and SOEs, saying rather than what happens at the moment, the Remuneration Authority, which sets pay for government employees like judges and politicians and so on, and does its work largely drawing on, for instance, private markets and market comparisons. If you were to add to their terms of reference that they, for instance, have to use a ratio approach, or that they have to consider the impact on income inequality in New Zealand in their work, you might get very different results about pay, because I think the comparison between the responsibilities and how a government department CEO or senior executive, how that compares with private sector is not being a total expert in job comparisons, I'm a bit wary about this, but I would suggest there's quite a difference and it would be quite appropriate for government to take a lead in restraining those differences. And related to that, of course, the SOEs, the state-owned enterprises, appear to be completely out of control in terms of what are letting their senior executives be paid packages that are clearly multi-million dollar packages seem totally inappropriate for an organisation that's owned by the government. And I think one of the things New Zealand doesn't do well is tax wealth. wealth taxes that could be implemented very quickly in this country if we chose to do it. Similarly, a high income, a sort of premium high income tax set at a pretty high level to capture those who are, I mean, it is ridiculous. The person on 70,000 pays the same tax rate as the person on 700,000, for instance. And there should be, say, 150,000 or 200,000 income, high income tax up from that level. And you'd have to work hard, of course, to ensure that's not avoided. But that would, things like that would deliver the ability immediately for government to intervene to help those on the lowest wages.
In January, Switzerland had a vote of a pay ratio of 12 to 1. That proposal was defeated, didn't happen. Given the research you've done, what would you say is the ideal pay ratio for New Zealand?
But a 1 to 10 ratio would be perhaps a really good place to start and ask that question of organisations. Mm. And it's interesting if you think our current Prime Minister, and we consider that would be a pretty a role worth rewarding in New Zealand, a fairly important leadership role, gets paid 15 times the minimum wage. Or if you do it using a living wage, which is the wage that's actually calculated as would actually support families to participate in New Zealand society, gets paid 11 times the living wage. So you might suggest that that would be in the range of what might be. You can look at companies, it's interesting how a company or how organisations are owned. Does it reflect, how their pay structures? So if it's a cooperative, for instance, cooperative business tends to have lower ratios between the lowest paid, although New Zealand's, I think it's probably, again, tricky to, depends what type of cooperative you're talking about.
Yes.
And similarly, if one of the other real factors in what can be done about this is involving having more workplace democracy, so involving workers in the decisions about who gets paid what more. For instance, having worker representatives on company remuneration committees and boards would have a really distributive effect, because workers have direct input and even the opportunity to veto excessive decisions.
When it comes to pushing for higher wages for the low paid, what is the New Zealand Council of Christian Services actually doing?
We're calling on those who are in the position of wealth, of high income, to look at what they're doing and take that moral decision, that decision to look after the interests of others. And the message accompanying that is you don't suffer. In fact, you're probably better off as well. Indeed, the kind of costs, if you want to call it that, involved in reducing income inequality in New Zealand and achieving a level that would be reasonable. I would say many of the highest incomes and wealth in New Zealand would barely notice.
Right.
It would be a little blip on the radar for them, and yet it could deliver so much benefit. So our message is really that we need to look at lifting the lowest incomes and finding ways to do that, but it's also important that those on the highest incomes show restraint, show some leadership, and take actively participate in that redistribution voluntarily and as a moral decision. But as a society, we do need to look at how we redistribute and regulate those gaps to ensure that those who don't want to do what is right, in fact, may well be acting against the interests of the whole of our society, also participate. So, obviously the taxation system and various regulatory controls are things we should be looking at. And there's a whole range of policies that could be implemented. And it's interesting, for instance, to compare New Zealand to a country like Japan, which is perhaps culturally quite different, but has traditionally very much lower gaps between highest and lowest paid in their organisation.
Oh, I see.
And yet, you wouldn't say Japan is one of the world's economic powerhouses. There is a real culture there of restraint around those gaps and interest in investing in employees across organisations.
If you speak to anyone running a listed company on any stock exchange you care to mention, they'll say their first responsibility is to the shareholders. They need to deliver their investors, their supporters, a profit, and pay them regular dividends. How does that square with paying staff more? Because these companies will argue they've got a legal responsibility to deliver a return to their shareholders.
I think it moves into the whole world of corporate social responsibility, corporate ethics, and I think boards and shareholders need to ask the question in whose their interests are deeply tied up with interests of the countries they live in and operate in, and they need to make their decisions taking into account the impact on all their workers and onto the wider society, because in the end, the well-being of the interests of the company, interests of shareholders, are deeply tied up with the well-being of the community those people come from, because they're from the same community. And I would urge those in those decision makings to take a strategic view of this and not look at the short term, but look at the generational impacts of their businesses. I believe there are quite a lot of people working in that area who understand the importance of this, and the more people who ask this question and put it on the board agenda, put it on the annual general meeting agenda, put it in their personal agendas. And when creative minds, when entrepreneurial minds decide to change the frameworks in which they work, for instance, to say we're going to have a ratio in this organisation and we're going to make it fly within that ratio, then things happen that benefit everybody, including your shareholders. So nobody loses and more people win.
That's Paul Barber, policy advisor of the New Zealand Council of Christian Services in Wellington. To find out more about the organisation, go to its website, www.nzccss.org.nz. You'll find a link to the organisation on the Steve Hart Radio Show website. Look.